Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This century, the 21st, will be the century when humanity essentially completes its long migration to cities, says my guest today. That's 2 or 3 billion people on the move. How they land in what he calls arrival cities and what they find there will be powerful factors in our politics and economies in the years ahead. This hour on Point, arrival cities and the face of the 21st century. You can join the conversation. Is this your city, your changing town, a migrant landing pad, a migrant launching pad? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from London is Doug Saunders. He's European Bureau Chief and columnist for the Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail. His new book is Arrival City: How the Largest Migration in History is Reshaping Our World. Doug Saunders, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Really good to be with you. Thanks.
I'm looking at this terrific map in the front piece of your book, and it is littered with big, you know, all-cap city names that I have never heard of. Kibera, yes. And Slotervart and Kreuzberg and Liukong Li and, mm-hmm. and right on down the line. What are these places that you're bringing our attention to, Doug?
Well, these are the districts in major cities of the world where people are arriving from villages and setting themselves up. They're the landing pad neighborhoods, the bottom rung neighborhoods, if you will. Often districts on the edge of major cities, although often in the undesirable lower rent areas near the center. I mean, Kibera in Nairobi is right in the very center. And some of these places have populations of hundreds of thousands of people. In places like Istanbul, the rural migrant landing pad neighborhoods account for maybe 10 of the 12 million people there.
So you say arrival cities, though very often these are big neighborhoods or very tough or scrappy neighborhoods, often leaning up against older, more established cities whose names we would know. But this is where what the infusion of migrant life tends to come.
Yes, and we should know them as North Americans, because our own cities and our own families' processes of urbanization generally happened through these bottom-rung neighborhoods. I mean, the Lower East Side of New York, mm-hmm. or the many parts of the major cities of the United States and Canada and Western Europe were these sort of landing pads during the 19th and much of the 20th centuries. And I think North Americans are used to the idea that these sort of neighborhoods, whether they're receiving people from the villages inside your country or from another country, that their default way of operating is success, that generally people arrive with a plan and they use their property and their small businesses and assistance from the community around them, attachment to the markets of the city, to build.
Sounds like we may have just looked, Doug,
and
are you
advance
there?
Yeah. themselves.
So that up by the bootstraps kind of rough and tumble, but let's find a way to get engaged with the society, wherever these cities may be planted, whether it's in China or in outside Amsterdam or London, you name it. That dynamic always, how do we get in? How do we get into the mainstream economy?
People never just show up in cities and hope for the best. There's always a specific plan in mind. I mean, in working on Arrival City, I visited about 20 such places on 5 continents. And I think I started out with this idea that at some point I would find a family somewhere in a village getting on a train and loading all their belongings on and going to a city. I thought, you know, 5 million people per month are becoming urbanites in the eastern and southern quadrants of the world. Surely I'd find a family doing this. And that just doesn't happen. You don't get people just embarking to the city. People send individual family members from the village to the city or to another country to make a start of it, to send some money back. And they send back information and strategies on how to get housing and get education and so on. And if their plans work, then these places become the new middle class. They become the pathways to success. Obviously, around the world, and whether in wealthy Western countries or in poorer countries, this process is being interrupted or blocked or stopped, because a lot of these neighborhoods are turning into tragic places.
But we'll talk about why, which ones work and which ones don't, and why that may matter so much. But you're saying it's essentially the same process going on at a rapid clip in this century, whether it's moving from the hinterlands of China to the edge of a big industrial city there, or from El Salvador to a neighborhood in Los Angeles. What is the big trend that this is part of, Doug?
What we're experiencing right now in the eastern and southern parts of the world is what Europe and North America did in between about the French Revolution and the middle of the 20th century, which is a shift from a subsistence-based, that is peasant-based, rural economy to a mainly urban economy. And we forget how quickly it shifted with us. I mean, you know, at the beginning of the 19th century, most Western countries were about three-quarters rural, and most of that rural was people farming for their own
family,
feeding
community.
Their families, or for their own starvation if it went wrong one season.
Yeah.
Mass starvation was a phenomenon in our countries until this urbanization process took place. We forget that once we got the people off the land, we were able to produce enough food for everybody. You know, most Western countries have something in the area of 2% of the population in agriculture, and they produce more food than much larger countries with 75% in agriculture.
But you're saying this century, the whole world is making that same turn.
Finally, this is now happening in a big way in the eastern and southern parts of the world. South America, it's basically finished. Places like Brazil are almost as urban now as North America. China is halfway through it now. Sub-Saharan Africa is maybe a quarter of the way through it. And it's happening very quickly, and it's very, very hard to stop. A very major military conflict can stop or reverse it. And if you look at where population growth is happening in the world now, which is to say the places that aren't urbanizing, it's a handful of countries that are having conflict troubles. Sudan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and so on. Most countries are urbanizing very quickly, and this is driving a lot of changes, most of them for the great improvement of people. I mean, when families urbanize, they become smaller, but almost every measure of quality of life improves. And this includes, generally, when people move into the worst sort of slums in cities. And we have to realize that. And this is the purpose of Arrival City, was to take a look at these places not as collections of very poor people who've somehow fallen out of the sky and infected a city, but as people who are on a trajectory, who've come from a village, which almost everyone in a slum does, and would move back if it becomes bad. And about half of them do move back. There's reverse migration. The people who are in the bottom rung neighborhoods are the best of the best in many ways. They're the most successful people in the villages who've managed to get themselves a foot in the urban economy. And they are those who are resilient enough not to move back despite the dangers and unhygienic living conditions of many of these neighborhoods.
So you're celebrating this. I mean, it gets into all kinds of issues depending on the country and on the circumstance. It can be about, you know, urban versus rural, or native versus immigrant, or all kinds of ethnic considerations can come in here. But you're saying this is part of a global trend. It's not going to be reversed, and as scruffy and scrappy and slum quality as many of these places are, you're saying this is the critical transition ground.
These are the places where either world poverty on the starvation level will end and a new middle class will be born, or where, if they're interrupted or mistreated, where the largest conflicts of our age will take place. And this is not just true for the cities of the world. This is true for the villages of the world. The largest source of financing for agriculture and villages in many countries, including China now, is money coming from the arrival city. And this means not just the arrival cities within China, but you can look at places like Bangladesh, which get more rural financing from East London than they do from any of their food sales combined, or from Central America, which probably gets more rural income from southern Los Angeles than it does from its own agricultural production.
The way these rough-and-tumble neighborhoods, communities, cities are structured, you say, critical to whether they go well and lead to integration and economic sort of, you know, net gain for everybody, or become real festering centers of discontent.
When you see these places going wrong, and look, they can go terribly wrong if anybody who's visited the favelas of Rio de Janeiro or many of the slums of sub-Saharan African cities will know that there can be terrible problems of criminality, of addiction, of poverty, of sanitation, children left with difficult lives, and every sort of urban horror you can imagine. This is always because something has been placed in the way of the natural function of these neighborhoods, whether it's something in terms of a physical barrier, which is very often the case, a simple inability to
physically access. A river, a highway, something.
Mm-hmm. River, a highway, often a bus route,
mm-hmm.
Is much more important than almost any other intervention you can make in these places, both because the people there often, you know, they're not all small businessmen and entrepreneurs. They're often people doing bottom rung jobs, house cleaning, sales of small items, and so on. To get to those jobs is often a 2-hour trip there and back. And this is true. This is as true of the outskirts of Paris or Washington D.C. as it is of Nairobi or Beijing. And if people take 3 hours to get to work each way, then their children are left with the empty patches between their houses as their main source of child care. And it's inevitable that gangs will form and so on. If the government has no place in these neighborhoods other than in annual police raids to get rid of drug gangs,
mm-hmm.
then they will fall criminal. So we have to pay some attention to them.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the scruffy, scrappy, marginal new cities, cities within cities, cities of migrants that will shape the 21st century. My guest today calls them arrival cities. A little music from Slumdog Millionaire behind us right there. Mumbai and its environs are on anybody's list, and many people saw that in the very popular movie that came out a couple of years ago. Doug Saunders joins us from London today. His new book is Arrival City: How the Largest Migration in History is Reshaping Our World. And he's talking about what he calls the last great phase of migration from rural areas to urban areas around the planet. Doug, I wish you'd paint a couple of these for us. I mean, a lot of people saw Slumdog Millionaire and understood very well that, you know, these kids, in that case, moving into the down and dirty slums of Mumbai, but where people really saw themselves as on the make, on the move, you know, with a chance. Give us some examples that we might not know so well of communities that are serving that function around the world. And I hope you'll include L.A. in your description.
Well, I did spend quite a bit of time in South L.A. I'd lived in Los Angeles in the late 90s and early 2000s during a period when it was really making a transition from being a place where the southern part had been largely African-American, poor neighborhood, that was badly hit with riots, which caused a large outflux of people. Anybody who made any kind of money moved out to the suburbs. The housing values, of course, dropped considerably. And we saw a large move in of people from Guatemala, Honduras, Salvador, Mexico, particularly when those countries were in conflict and so on. What this actually did was transform large parts of southern L.A. From being a place of intergenerational poverty and dependency to being an arrival city. That is, to a place where people are on a project of advancement, not always successful, but quite often so. And you could tell it in the little bungalow houses that make up much of that area. They became painted. Their gardens became planted. Trees started to grow and so on. This is because the difference between sort of a slum of relegation of what people fall into and an arrival city slum is not the poverty rate, which can be quite similar, but is the ambition and the trajectory that people are on. People there, when they made a bit of money, they didn't move out to the suburbs. The Central Americans would buy their little houses and set up a small business maybe in the back or in the front of them and so on. So you get shops forming, and small economies inside forming and attempts to reach the consumer market of greater Los Angeles and so on. And a slow advancement of the neighborhood. And you see people saving to get their kids into university and so on. And you can't always tell. One of the tricky things is you can't always tell by the poverty rate, because if an arrival city neighborhood is successful, that often means it's sending people out into more successful neighborhoods, into not quite middle-class neighborhoods, but maybe better quality neighborhoods in the city, at such a pace that it's constantly taking in new people as tenants and homeowners from the originating villages and so on. And that keeps the poverty rate low, even though the neighborhood is a success. And governments misread this, and they say, well, what we need is social workers and welfare support and so on. Maybe what they need are small business support, easier zoning laws, bus connections to the city, and so on. We have to be very careful with policy to see who's not just what's wrong in a neighborhood, but what the trajectory is, what the plan is. Ask people, instead of asking people what's wrong, ask them where are you going and how can we help you get there.
You may see a lot of poverty, but it may in fact be the face of what you describe as almost a kind of transformation machine, moving people through this migration. You say, though, you remind us that arrival cities, as you call them, are widely misunderstood and often distrusted, dismissed as static slums rather than places of dynamic change, Doug.
Well, yeah, and look, even the people moving into them know that they can be dangerous and tricky places. I mean, Slumdog Millionaire presented a fairly decent visual picture of what the Dharavi slum in Mumbai looks like. It didn't quite present the right picture of what it's being used for by people from villages moving through. The fact is most of the people in it own their little 10 by 12 foot tin-roofed dirt floor shacks and are using the rising property value of those to get credit finance on the informal market to finance small businesses and so on. In a lot of those shacks, you'll see an old PC in the back with the oldest daughter in the family studying JavaScript programming or something in order to make advancement and so on. So there is a trajectory. And there's also the knowledge of the people who live there that, yes, if things go badly, as they do in these neighborhoods, it can be bad. You can get terrible diseases. There are addictions and so on. And if things were really bad, you might have your children go out and sell individual cigarettes on the street or something, as you see in India quite often. But if things go bad in the village, your children can die. And that's the significant difference. Most really serious poverty is rural poverty around the world. And there is a calculation going on of cost and benefits among these people. And people, when you meet them in the villages and you meet them on their ways to the cities, as I do with many of the families I visit and whose stories I tell in Arrival City, you find they have a very acute knowledge of exactly what the opportunities are in the landing pad neighborhoods of the city versus what the losses would be in the village and when to move forward and when to turn back.
You write about, in particular, and we're going to go there in just a moment, you write about Brazil, Sao Paulo, Rio, and how the favelas, famous favelas there, of course, President Obama has just been in Brazil, but about how those have, so much drug business has come out of those over a long time. But then, with President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva coming in, for example, in Santa Marta, in Rio, he came in and said that this was going to be his test bed for transformation here, trying to move it from just a kind of a drug swamp into a real arrival city, as you'd have it, as a base for people to launch instead of sink into the drug trade. We're going to go to Rio in just a moment, but what's your sense of how that's gone? Does Brazil have effective arrival city dynamics?
It does now. Remember, Brazil, along with Turkey, is one of the few countries that actually has been governed by a government coming from the arrival city. Lula himself was an arrival city leader. He was a child of these neighborhoods. Still, a lot of them are governed by the drug gangs. I mean, this is what stepped in and filled the gap when the government of Brazil fell apart and was displaced by a coup in the 70s and 80s. And there are projects to turn them around. I would say in Sao Paulo, the larger city, they're more successful because they've had very activist municipal governments who've really understood the nature of these neighborhoods. Rio, which of course is going to be host to two major world sporting events soon, is in need of serious interventions. And yes, Lula's projects to turn around some of those favelas have been interesting, and they've used principles that the world should watch. Unfortunately, there are about 700 such neighborhoods, and only a fraction of them have been transformed so far. There's a lot of work to be done, but there are a lot of lessons to be learned in Brazil.
Let's go to Brazil for a moment, to Rio, just to check in. While we're on the subject, Damian Platt joins us. He's author of Culture as Our Weapon, Making Music and Changing Lives in Rio de Janeiro. We've spoken with Damian before. Damian, thank you so much for being with us from Rio de Janeiro today.
Hi, Tom.
What's your sense at this point of how the favelas are working to integrate or to isolate the Brazilians that you work with? Do you see them as transformation machines? Do you see where the Brazilian government has been effective or where it's failed in making these communities into pathways to integration in the national economy, Damian?
Well, it's as Doug was saying, that the situation has changed in recent years, largely thanks to Lula's administration and his project called the Plan for Accelerated Growth, which is a national project and which has some big infrastructure investment schemes in big favelas here in Rio. So the overall policy is changing, and Rio itself is changing very fast because of the investment coming in for the Olympics and the Soccer World Cup, and also because the state government, for the first time in many years, has started working with the federal government. So there is a sense of change in Rio, and as well as that, they're also working with the municipal government, the mayor's office. So I think for the first time there's a sense of change, but as Doug says, there's only a small fraction of the actual total number of favelas that are receiving the investment. And in fact, it's favelas which are obviously strategic, so the ones in the south of the city nearest the beaches, and then the one near the football stadiums and near major transport arteries. But there is a sense in the city that finally it's beginning to turn the page after basically 30 years of criminal mismanagement and corruption and violence. Although my concern is that there are some favelas being changed, but what's going to happen to the other ones where there aren't enough resources to invest in the long term? And there also sometimes seems to be a lack of thinking about tackling what is essentially a territorial armed conflict in the long term. But I'd say essentially Rio is changing, and the situation for people who live in favelas is slowly beginning to get better. But we're still a way off of overcoming the cultural prejudices and some of the root problems.
Damien, what do you mean when you say a territorial armed conflict? What do you mean by that?
Well, they've lived since the 80s, most favelas, in fact nearly all of them, have been taken over by groups linked to drug trafficking, and then more recently groups called militias, which are paramilitary groups linked to the police. Mm-hmm. So you have whole territories which are controlled by an armed group that is not the state and will enter in conflict or in corrupt relations with the state. So it means that you could have areas of 100,000, 150,000 people where the rules in that area where those people live are made by people other than the state, so in illegal groups. And the armed conflict would be battles between drug gangs and the police or between drug gangs and themselves, and also them imposing a martial law on the residents. So it's a very serious situation that has come over the last 20, 30 years, and that only now the government's really showing a sort of strategic interest in tackling this long term.
Damian Platt, author of Culture is Our Weapon, thank you for that report from Rio de Janeiro. Thank you so much, Damian.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
Doug Saunders, you know, there are efforts that are working out here, and at the same time, that lingering risk in Rio, anyway, of a territorial armed conflict right behind the goal, as Lula da Silva had it, of integrating through those poor neighborhoods.
Yes, he's having to fight back against two generations of neglect, and one of the world's most acute examples of what can happen when these neighborhoods are mistreated. And really, Brazil, for about 30 years, either tried to eliminate the favelas, stop people from moving in from the villages to the city, or simply pretend that they didn't exist. And of course, that's not going to happen. I mean, if the economy of the city wants people, which it did, and if the standard of living is that much higher, which it was, then these neighborhoods are going to form. People will find a way to do it. The problem was that if the government then decides that they don't exist, something will step in to govern them. And in Brazil's case, it was the drug gangs, and they still do govern it, and they govern it to a large degree. I mean, if you want to buy fuel for your cooking stove in your house, mm-hmm. and you live in a favela, you have to buy it from the drug gang at 3 or 4 times the market price. If you go out and buy it at a shop and bring it into the favela, they will kill you. The kids who stand at the gate with assault rifles in their jeans will shoot you if you do that. So
this is not the vision of the effective arrival city that you paint, Doug.
No, but remember, the people who are living there still have that trajectory in mind. Sometimes 40, 50 years on, I'd meet people. First of all, they're still sending a lot of money back to their villages. The favela is the main means of village support in northeastern Brazil, which is where most of these people mm-hmm. have come from. And yes, they're stuck. I mean, they've turned themselves wrong, and this is true in many places of the world. And you could say the same thing about the African American neighborhoods of the northern U.S. cities in the 20th century, which began as arrival cities in almost exactly the same way. The ambitions of the people moving from the south from a very oppressive rural economic situation were the same process of investment, of plans for education and small business and property success that we see in the outskirts of many cities now. Mm. And we're interrupted with processes of physical isolation, bureaucratic limitations, usually driven by racism, and all the other things that we see interrupting places now and turned into places of backwardness, criminality, poverty, and so on during a long period in the late 20th century just begun turning themselves around during the last 20, 30 years. So in North America, we know this story as well.
We'll look at your formula for trying to avoid that. Melissa in Nashville is calling. Hi, Melissa. Thanks. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'd like to ask your guest if he's given any thought to what's going to happen to the land, the environment, when people start all going to piling up in cities. Will it give the land a break, or does he just see the entire world becoming a giant sprawl?
Urban sprawl. Yeah. What about if everybody's moving to these cities one way or another out of the villages? What does that mean for agriculture, for nature?
There are three consequences here. The first one's positive, which is that once you get people out of subsistence agriculture, moving into the city, and the land stops becoming a place that's supporting populations and starts being a place that can produce food. I mean, Europe and North America now produce many times more food than they can consume, and that's because they got all but a couple percent of the population off the land, and it could turn into productive agriculture rather than peasant agriculture. The second thing is a negative thing, which is that when people move to the city, yes, they consume more resources each. They often make enough money to have a motorcycle, if not a car, and they have, new resources and things. They also urbanize their villages a bit by sending money. So, yes, that's ecologically bad. But the third thing, which is ecologically very good, is that populations go down dramatically. I mean, everywhere
smaller
in the
families.
World, when people move to the city, their families drop wildly down below the 2.1 children per family point that makes populations stable to a shrinkage point. I mean, a classic example would be Iran, which in the mid-80s had 8 children per family. It now has 1.7, and that certainly wasn't for cultural reasons. It was purely because of urbanization.
We'll go out with Marcelo D2, the Brazilian rapper. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Little music there from Los Hermanos Flores. You might hear it in many streets in Los Angeles these days, one of the so-called arrival cities that my guest Doug Saunders is writing and talking about. The scruffy, scrappy, marginal new cities, cities within cities often, cities of migrants that he says will shape the 21st century. His new book is Arrival City, How the Largest Migration in History is Reshaping Our World. You've got interesting questions here online, Doug. Doug Saunders joins us in London. Here's one from Tina. She says, a major difference from the distant past when these kind of migrations were going on, she writes, is also a major obstacle to individuals and families building success in these cities. She says, small shops cannot survive when Walmart looms. Thus, a major route out of poverty, owning your own small shop, is blocked by the scale of corporate capitalism. What do you say, Doug?
Well, I think there are geographical problems of which the big box store is a small part that are changing the nature of bottom-rung migrant neighborhoods. In the 20th century in North America and much of Europe, the places where new immigrants, usually from village places somewhere, would land were often the poor row house neighborhoods near the center of the city and so on. In many North American cities, it was the old Victorian housing, which until the 70s was considered undesirable by established middle class people. And the immigrants came into those neighborhoods. And when I grew up in Toronto, I certainly was surrounded by Chinese and Portuguese and Italians using this cheap housing stock as a place to start businesses and so on. The problem is that now that housing is often priced out of the market of new immigrants and, in fact, is quite desirable. And the new immigrant landing pads increasingly, and I'd say in the majority in the United States, are in the inner ring suburbs. And the suburbanization of immigration creates a bunch of problems in that the distances are much larger. People often don't have cars. The bus routes are often not very good at all. And when you start a small business, first of all, you have zoning restrictions, which make it difficult to start a small factory or a shop or restaurant in your house. And second of all, it's hard to get consumers from the inner city, from the wealthier neighborhoods, to come and buy your products and eat at your restaurant and so on. We need to get around those barriers. I think those are more important than competition from big boxes and so on. I mean, we've seen neighborhoods that have embraced their nature as an arrival city really thrive and succeed in a big way, drawing consumers in and so on, become places where people are attracted to the restaurants and shops and so on as an alternative to the homogeneity of the big box shop and so on. Places that are willing to acknowledge that this is what they are often are much more successful than those that try to fight it. I mean, one of the things I do in Arrival City is I compare and contrast neighborhoods on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. that have either resisted casual labor pools and low-rent migrant neighborhoods forming amidst them and have run into conflicts and that have impoverished them versus places that have advertised the fact that they are homes of Hispanic culture and good food and so on and have attracted people.
You're talking about Herndon, Wheaton there. It's interesting that the number one amenity, if that's the right word for it, that you say is important in making these successful is bus service. I mean, you alluded to it, but is that for people to go out, and taste the ethnic cuisine, or for the inhabitants there to get into the central city or wherever it may be where the economic activity is and engage it?
It works both ways. And this is both true in poorer countries and in wealthy countries, that transportation is often much more important than things that you would think are much more important, including in neighborhoods that don't even really have decent water and sanitation supplies yet. Yes, those are important. People do notice those. I'm not downplaying those. But often the ability to get yourself to your job and vice versa, get people from outside the neighborhood to your shop is of huge importance to people and needs to be taken seriously as the distances increase and so on. Housing densities are important as well. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the outskirts of Amsterdam, which spiraled into a terrible decay of criminality and terrorism that erupted essentially to really hurt the politics of the Netherlands. And a lot of the problem, if you asked the Moroccans and Turks who lived there, involved a type of housing that seemed very desirable to the Dutch people and to a lot of North Americans when it was built, which was windy streets, low-slung buildings with big green spaces between them. it looked really pleasant for people moving out from downtown. But that never really happened. People never really moved out from downtown. What you got was people moving in from a village in another country, trying to use these as landing pads, discovering that it was 3 bus transfers to get to work and that their kids essentially kicked around in the courtyard between buildings in lieu of childcare. And they couldn't physically start any sort of business in the area because these buildings were so tightly zoned and so on. Mm-hmm. Physically, these neighborhoods were stopped people from doing the new immigrant thing and getting going.
Which is a little more chaotic, and that can be good. The sort of street cart, you name it, up by the bootstraps, mm-hmm. little enterprise. We've got lots of callers for you. Let me get one if I may. Tracy in Stowe, Vermont. Tracy, you're on with Doug Saunders.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Doug. Mm-hmm. It's great to hear your voice because you've been my favorite journalist with the Globe and Mail for quite a while.
Well, thank you.
I actually find myself on a little bit of the other side of you on this issue because I'm involved in rural economic development, and I just happen to be in Vermont at the moment. One of the things is that you said earlier about European and North American agriculture. Well, that never could have happened without, one, the Second World War, and two, the inputs of subsidies, because you never would have got capitalization and industrialization in the agricultural sector. Now, my question to you is, because what I see in my research is the cost of running low-density urban areas and also high-density urban areas. And the statistics show that in North America, primarily you're looking at, for every tax dollar taken in, it takes about $1.09 to $1.16 to provide services for high-density urban areas. And for low-density urban areas, it ranges from like, for every tax dollar taken in, it's $1.23 to $1.65.
Tracy, are you suggesting that it's more cost-effective for countries, societies, to keep their populations down on the farm, Tracy?
Well, I'm not saying it's just down on the farm. It's just that what's going to happen in these urban areas is that as they become wealthier, cities are going to have to start providing services for them. And I'm wondering if Mr. Saunders has taken into consideration the impact of, in the last sort of 15 years, we've had really, really low agricultural prices, so people couldn't survive mm-hmm. on the land. Mm-hmm. And therefore, what that, you know, wave of the last 20 years of low prices created a wave into the urban areas.
Let us pick it up if we may, and thank you, Tracy. Doug Saunders, what do you say?
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Thanks. I mean, the low prices of the last 40 years, really until 2008, until the food price shock of 2008, food prices were extremely low, which actually prevented a lot of change in rural areas around the world. It meant that there was no incentive to stop being a subsistence peasant farmer, even if there was huge risks in crop failure doing great damage to your family and so on. Because there wasn't a lot more to be made by going into more productive forms of farming and urbanizing part of your population and so on. It kept people stuck. And I'd say that a lot of foreign aid during the last 20 years shifted that way because it became easier to give foreign aid to villages rather than to transitional urban areas. It's very easy to measure an input and a success. And a lot of that foreign aid had the side effect of kind of paying people to stay in peasant farming. Because if you ask the people in peasant farms what they want to do, they often don't know about anything else yet. And they'll say, well, I'd like to have just a better quality sanitation life, whatever, within the paradigm of farming this way. Mm. And it almost proved a disincentive to getting people out of peasant farming, to getting one foot in the city, to creating a system where you can expand your holdings a bit and become more productive. This is changing fast now that food prices are higher. There are more incentives to change farming into something that is productive, to change cities into places that are linked better and that are financing agriculture. We're finally seeing India, which has been very stuck on the idea of very low productivity peasant farming, starting to get some money coming in from the cities and paying to change farms, get some proper irrigation in, and so on and turn them around. She's quite right that low-density urban neighborhoods are a huge problem. One of the great successes in turning places around could be increasing population density, as I alluded to in discussing the outskirts of Amsterdam there. And one of their solutions was to knock down these widespread, sprawling estates on the outskirts and put in 8 to 10-story buildings in neat grid patterns that looked kind of like the Lower East Side of New York, with the bottom two floors devoted to factories and shops and so on.
Right.
Almost under the philosophy that if you change the physical appearance of a neighborhood, you increase its density and bustle and also its access to the main city economy, then the culture and economy of immigration will follow from that physical shape. It's an interesting experiment. It's one that ought to be watched.
Give it that kind of ferment. Tracy, thanks for your call. One right here from Norfolk, Virginia. Michael. Michael, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Doug Saunders.
Thank you, Tom Ashbrook. Thank you, Doug Saunders. Let's not forget that the Roman Empire fell because it did not control immigration. It's happening in China now. Poor people outside of China, even poorer than the ones already inside China, are flooding into that country, and they are being given jobs because they will work for even less than the poor Chinese. You talked about Amsterdam. Amsterdam has been on the verge of destruction because of its unregulated immigration policy. We see what's happening in California. The state is on the verge of being in our pockets to save it. There has to be control. The New Jerusalem that the Bible talks about has a wall built around it, and it has rules limiting who can go in and go out of it.
Michael, our time is short, but I'm very glad you called with that perspective. Doug, I'm sure this is not the first time you get this pushback, seeing people saying, you're saying let's celebrate and facilitate, it's inevitable. Michael's saying, well, you hear it. We may need a wall here and some control. You can't just absorb all this. It's the fall of Rome.
I've avoided any discussion of whether to be pro or anti-immigration or what level it should be in any particular country, because there are legitimate political reasons to be controlling immigration at some point or another, or setting limits and so on. What I'm instead looking at here is what will happen. I'm saying, okay, we can have a debate somewhere else about what should or shouldn't happen as far as people moving in. We need to look at what is going to happen. And the fact is that regardless what your policies are in the medium term, in the longer term, in the 10-year, 15-year, 20-year interval, you're going to have in a country like the United States a few hundred thousand immigrants a year coming in, whether legally or not. The economy is going to demand them, and the existing networks of people within the country are going to demand them. There's not some pre-existing population of the non-immigrants who aren't bringing relatives in. I mean, North American countries are entirely made up of networks of immigrants. There is no non-immigrant stock except for the Aboriginal populations. Mm-hmm. And that's a powerful political force. And so are labor shortages. It's not very easy to fill labor shortages today other than with immigration. China is experiencing something approaching population shrinkage and indeed is going to need to start taking in immigrants. It's only getting a few tens of thousands now, but this will be
China is going to need immigrants itself, 1.3 billion, and that's not enough?
In the Pearl River Delta, you're starting to get some African immigrants brought in to deal with the persistent labor shortages. I mean,
wow.
Shenzhen, the great industrial city sure. of southern China, has had to raise its minimum wage about 10 times in the last 4 years in order to keep millions of people from moving back to the cities of central China because the pay levels simply are not enough. There are large-scale labor shortages there. And we're almost reaching an area where, you know, people talk about peak oil when things become very competitive, when oil stocks start to fall. We're almost reaching an era, not quite yet, but very soon, of what you might call peak people, when rather than countries trying to develop policies to keep people out, there's going to be a lot of competition for even fairly unskilled laborers as the stock of people available starts to fall. Europe has run out of Eastern Europeans and is starting to try to look to Northern Africa and the Middle East for to fill labor shortages and so on. And this will be a reality. I mean, it's every time there have been attempts at policies to stop people coming in from the city, including quite aggressive political policies, it has maybe affected things by 10 to 15 to 20%. The Reagan presidency, the Gingrich Congress, both passed very aggressive laws to try to control immigration from the countries to the south of the United States. And the effect of these was to actually see an increase in these numbers and to result in mass amnesties for people who'd arrived without papers. If those governments couldn't do that, and the government of Nicolas Sarkozy in France, for example, was unable to do it, I suspect the economy is going to continue to require people. So instead, let's put aside that debate and let's plan for the assumption that there will be people arriving at various points during the next 20 years, regardless of policy, and make sure that they become a successful middle class. They go through the process that the Irish and Italians and Eastern European Jews and Chinese who entered North America in the 20th century went through, where their children and grandchildren became part of the political and economic mainstream and educated success stories. Let's make sure that the next wave of arrival city neighborhoods serve the same function that those people's neighborhoods did.
And if that doesn't happen, is it a police problem or a political problem, a significant political problem for a country, a community, Doug?
If you fail to put a certain investment into the immigration process now, you will have a much larger expense coming up in the future as things fall into criminality and marginality. That becomes the only way for people to survive in these neighborhoods.
Doug Saunders, he says this is it. This is the century when it all comes. Urban joined us today from London. His new book is Arrival City, How the Largest Migration in History is Reshaping Our World. Doug, thank you you've emptied notebooks here out of your travels to many, many cities and communities around the world. It's really a very interesting take on what we're in the midst of right now. We appreciate your time and thoughts today. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, and great thank you to everyone for calling in as well. It was wonderful.
Doug Saunders, Arrival City is the book. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you for joining us.